On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Change your history, then the voting booth is the place to be. So come alive and vote for Clive. He's your guy for the Senate drive.
Clive Gray for U.S. Senate.
.com.
That's Gray with an E. Bringing the people's voice to Washington. Clive Gray for U.S. Senate.com.
I'm Clive Gray, and I approve this message.
Clive Gray, one of the 34 candidates running for Barbara Boxer's Senate seat. He won't be on stage tonight in Stockton for the first debate in the race, but the top two Democrats and three Republicans will be. Although California is solidly Democratic when it comes to the Senate, polls say that somewhere between a third and a half of voters are still undecided. And with such a crowded field, there is plenty of opportunity for confusion. Rafe Sonnenschein is going to help make sense of all this. He's executive director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. Hey, Rafe.
Good to be with you, Madeline.
Great to have you. Well, first of all, why are Republicans and Democrats on stage together?
Well, in 2010, voters, in their wisdom, created the top two primary system in which everybody runs together in the primary. You can choose to identify yourself as a Democrat or a Republican on the ballot. You're not required to. And the top two candidates run off in November. So if you're going to have a primary, you've got to put the leading Democrats and the leading Republicans up on the stage and see which two survive.
Okay, well, let's talk about the leading Democrats. You've got Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez versus California Attorney General Kamala Harris. Harris is ahead of Sanchez in the polling, I understand. What are the major differences between these two candidates?
Well, we're not quite sure. Some of it is regional. Kamala Harris is the Northern Californian and Loretta Sanchez is the Southern Californian. Obviously, there's representing somewhat different groups. Kamala Harris is African-American. Loretta Sanchez is Latina. Some people would say that representing an Orange County district, Loretta Sanchez is a little bit more centrist and that Kamala Harris is a little bit more on the liberal side. But they're both well within the kind of mainstream of the Democratic Party.
Now, some have said, oh, well, Kamala Harris is going to run away with this because she's ahead and she's better known and she's sort of locked up the major Democratic support. However, couldn't Sanchez benefit from this being a very unusual election year with high turnout and a lot of Latino people upset over Donald Trump being on the ballot and coming out to vote?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Kamala Harris is the heavy favorite. If this was a sports event, basically Loretta Sanchez is the scrappy underdog who could surprise the leading candidate, especially if the leading candidate runs a very safe and predictable campaign, as leading candidates often do. This hasn't been a year that's been very kind to people who are rounding up tons of endorsements. So she's certainly the favorite. The top two probably benefit Sanchez a bit, because if she is seen as a little bit more moderate, remember that Republicans can vote in the general election for either of these two Democrats if they both make it in, and she might have some options to win some votes there. Also, we expect a fairly high Latino vote this year, at least in part because of Donald Trump on the Republican side.
Right. Okay, so on the Republican side, the leading candidates are two former state GOP chairmen, Tom Del Beccaro and Duff Sunheim. Do they have a hope?
Well, they have no hope in November. I mean, I think we can just write that off. But they have a chance to get in. The sad thing for Republicans is that they really need just one Republican on the stage to have a good chance at getting into that second spot. It's hard for me to see how they'll do it with three candidates, each of whom have some recognition. The irony for Republican voters this year is they would have more influence on this race if the two Democrats get into the runoff than if one of the Republicans gets into the runoff, who would be sure to lose. They could be the balance of power between two Democrats, and the candidates would go after their votes. That's one of the oddities of this system, is that you end up potentially with more say when what you want in the short term you don't get, which is to get your party into the finals.
Okay, well, let's talk about a late entry. His name is Ron Unz. He may be familiar to some listeners. He ran for governor in 1994. He's a millionaire. He was behind ballot initiatives to deny social services to undocumented immigrants and to eliminate bilingual education here in California. What is he doing on this ballot?
Well, I think he's in here to try to preserve his previous ballot measure on bilingual education, which he's worried would be overturned by the voters in November. And there's also the why not factor. The financial and signature requirements to get on this ballot are pretty small. I think a lot of people are now kicking themselves and saying, why the heck didn't I just run just so I could say I ran for the Senate? So he's got an issue that's important to him. Plus, the immigration issue will probably come up in the debate. And definitely given his earlier history on the immigration issue, he probably feels he's got something to say. So there is very much also the why not factor.
He's an interesting character. Can you talk a little bit more about him? Because wasn't he behind this move to make Harvard free for everybody?
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of quirky. He's all over the map in some degree ideologically. I wouldn't call him a traditional Republican. Remember, he's running against two Republican former chairs of the state party in California. So my guess is he's also thinking that in a year of Donald Trump, somebody with unpredictable views ideologically might have a shot. And who's to say that things don't fall his way and he somehow sneaks into the number two spot? It wouldn't be impossible.
Yeah, I understand he's supporting Bernie Sanders.
Well, there you go. I mean, everything's topsy-turvy. And there are some sort of things around the Sanders-Trump world that sort of intersect. And I've just given up predicting almost anything this year, by the way, Madeline.
Okay. Well, there are other candidates on the ballot, as we heard earlier, 34 in all. So what does it take to get on the ballot?
Oh, it takes the filing fee is 1% of the annual salary of a U.S. senator, which comes out to, I believe, $34.80, which is not that impossible, or 10,000 signatures, which in a state like this is not that hard.
And that's $3,480, not $34.80.
Oh, no, then I would have run it. It was $34.80. No, it's $3,480. And this reminds me of the recall against Gray Davis in 2003, where there are, I believe, 135 candidates on the race. It becomes kind of American Idol.
Yeah.
And why not? And there's a certain value, I think, of lots of people putting their names in at this stage. There's no chance any of them will be around in November. But it does, well, certainly has an entertainment value for all of us. But it's kind of democratic in a way. The bar is pretty low for getting on this. And most of these folks, some of them actually have some interesting things to say, I guess, but a lot of them really just, of course, are going nowhere.
Do you have a favorite of these others?
Oh, I like the people who, in their comments, put down nothing except their name and a title. Like one says, constitutionalist. I don't really want to make fun of people who have the nerve to put their name in, but there's some pretty quirky things. There's some pretty, seem like some solid people who in another kind of universe might have gotten into politics earlier and run for some offices and got some recognition, but they're not going to get taken seriously for the U.S. Senate.
There's one guy whose candidate statement is just a series of numbers, 011-00101. And apparently he says that in computer programming, this code translates to the letter E, as in e-voting.
Yes, so that's exactly right. It's pretty clever. That's Jason Hanania, and I think that in the world we're in, there is a feeling that anybody can post something on Facebook, anybody can send a tweet, and it's the world we're in, and you know, in some ways, it's nice to have an opening every once in a while for that to happen in politics.
Yeah, so anyone can run for a United States Senator.
Yeah.
If they have 3480. All right, Rafe, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
That's Rafe Sonnenschein, Executive Director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. Are you one of the many undecided voters in this race for Barbara Boxer's Senate seat? Is it because you can't make up your mind amongst all those candidates, 34 candidates? Or did you even know there was a Senate election happening? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Last month, we reported on Elvis Summers, a man in South LA who builds tiny houses for the homeless.
I have two windows, one on each side with blue curtains, thin enough to allow the breeze to come through. You know, I keep my keys around, you know, a keychain that I hang around my neck. You know, it's a constant reminder with it around my neck that I have something that I can call mine.
That's Kevin Green, the proud recipient of one of these tiny houses. And by tiny, I mean 6 feet wide and 8 feet long. Elvis Summers has given away 37 of these mini homes so far. But in February, the city's sanitation department confiscated about a dozen of them from a South LA sidewalk. Mayor Eric Garcetti's office said at the time that the structures weren't safe. Now, the mayor seems to have done an about-face. His office says it'll return the impounded houses. It's not clear yet where they're going to go. Elvis Summers is here now in the studios. Welcome.
Hi.
So what's your reaction to this change of heart?
I mean, you know, they took the houses. They shouldn't have. They agreed to give them back, so that's a good thing.
So where have they been until now?
They've been stored in a Department of Sanitation lot over by Dodger Stadium in Tiny House Jail.
Now where are they going to be?
Well, now they're going to be stored at one of the places I'm allowed to store stuff, most likely a church in Compton. The city damaged all of the houses, so it's going to take me some time to repair them. The houses are about 1,000 pounds, so I mean, I got to lift them up, and because it's the wheels on the bottom that they damaged. So
I see.
I'm not very concerned with, you know, suing over, you know, that little bit of money. I mean,
right.
I'll get it back, but it's not my top priority.
So what is your top priority at this point?
Saving lives. People are on the street dying. I mean, once again, as we speak, one of my people is missing again. You know, he's got some bad health problems. You know, he's a Vietnam veteran. He's missing.
Did he have a tiny house?
He did. A very beautiful one.
So that one will go back? Where will it be?
They're all in storage right now. I mean, I until somebody steps up with some private land, or I raise enough money to, you know, buy or lease, you know, my own land, I'm stuck.
So they can't go back on city-owned land?
No, they can't. And that was their concern when they called to say they were going to give them back. You know, they wanted me to give them proof that I had somewhere to store them. And, you know, it's like, you took something that's not yours, give it back.
So you have them in storage? You have a place to store them?
I have a place to store them. They haven't given them back yet, but sometime this week, I'm sure.
And what you're looking for now is a permanent place to put these homes so the homeless can move into them.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much more involved than just the tiny homes. It's just all I've been able to do. People need showers and bathrooms and services and, you know, all kinds of stuff. But we can build that in small communities, which would immediately get people off the streets and into, you know, a much more humane, safe shelter until permanent housing becomes available. When the city called me to return, you know, the houses, the mayor's homeless policy director, we had a good talk, and she'd said that she was going to give me a list, you know, of properties that, you know, she'll give me the addresses I can go through, and we can, you know, pick some that are like, you know, that'll work best. And I thought it was amazing. It was really great. And like, all of a sudden they're like backtracking, going, we didn't have an agreement or anything going on. We don't support the tiny house village idea. I mean, there's a miscommunication somewhere, but the city has over 7,500 that they know of vacant properties.
You're thinking, why not rehab those?
Absolutely.
And put the homeless there temporarily.
Exactly. I'm starting to not buy the statements that they're still trying to find a location for homeless storage or to do this, to do that. I'm like, what's the problem? You know, where's the hiccup? Like, we can do something today. Like, Monday, you know.
And then meanwhile, do you have anyone who has their own private empty lot who would be willing to give you their land temporarily for these tiny homes?
No, not yet. But as of, I guess right now, I have now partnered with the Vet Hunters who've graciously decided to give me a fiscal sponsorship, and I get to use their 501c. So now I get to play in the big leagues, and I think a lot of larger donations and or people wanting to donate land or leases or whatever it is, like, have held back because I didn't have that 501c3 to give them, and now I do.
Okay, so how can they contact you? If someone wants to donate?
Yeah. They can. I guess the easiest step is just to go to one of our websites, mythblood.org. It's mythpla.org, and there's a contact form on there.
Mythpla.
Yeah, Mythpla. It's like the word myth and then PLA.
Okay.
I know, it's kind of weird, huh? But it's an acronym for My Tiny House Project LA.
Gotcha. Okay.
So they can hit the contact form and reach me there, and then I can send them my, you know, personal contact info.
Okay. Elvis Summers, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, what do you think? Where should these tiny houses go, and would you like to see them in your neighborhood? Leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, a massive American aid package to Honduras is threatened after a popular environmental activist is murdered. We'll find out who Berta Cáceres was and how she galvanized the nation. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 60 members of Congress are questioning a giant $750 million aid package designated for parts of Central America, including Honduras. In a letter to Secretary of State John Kerry, they want some aid withheld pending an independent investigation into the killing of a Honduran activist. Berta Cáceres was shot dead in her home last month. She was internationally known for her work opposing a hydroelectric dam in a rural part of Honduras. Some people suspect that the military and the police were complicit in her murder and that the Honduran government is now involved in a cover-up. Here with me now is her nephew and freelance independent journalist, Silvio Carrillo. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you. Who do you think killed your aunt?
Well, that's a pretty big question, especially in a place as small as Honduras. The ruling elite, the business elite, has controlled Honduras since the coup. The 2009 coup, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they played a major role in bringing about the coup. They controlled the Supreme Court, the military, and all the major means of communication in Honduras. And these are the same people that created these concessions since the coup, that sold off these concessions, these parcels of land where they could create mining projects or hydroelectric power plants on lands belonging to indigenous people. And so, you know, that it's murky and it's purposely murky, but it could have been anyone from someone who worked at the dam to anyone related to these business interests.
What was it about your aunt Berta Cáceres and her activism that you think so threatened the elite?
Well, she had gained so much notoriety. She knew that the key to success for these indigenous people, the Lenca, that she partly belonged to through her father, was solidarity. So solidarity with other indigenous movements around the world. And she started gaining prominence for her work, for her struggle, for her protests. And this was recognized by the Goldman Foundation and several other organizations. That wasn't the only prize she won, but she gained a lot of notoriety, and for once, Honduras had an indigenous hero, sort of like Rigoberta Menchú in Guatemala, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in the 90s. And so she was becoming a big deal in Honduras and outside of Honduras, which was a huge problem for this business elite, because if she had become president at some point, she would have done away with all of these projects. And there's 10 to 15 families that own everything in Honduras. And so she was a major problem for them, a growing problem, and they recognized that.
Was that her ambition, to one day become president?
No, not at all.
Oh, okay.
Not at all. But I think this work could have taken her there. Mm-hmm. Her ambition was to have a just world, you know, have these people have their rights recognized. And it's something that she was born and bred with. Like I would visit her and my grandmother in summers growing up. She was only 2 years older than I, so we were very close. And we would, on my short visits, I would see children who were dying of diarrhea, you know, just ridiculous things that you would never think of. She lived this every day of her life. There was a long line of people waiting to see my grandmother, who was a midwife in the town where she would serve indigenous people who had no other means for medical treatment.
So, yeah, so Berta, she was only 45 when she was killed last month. And what has happened in the investigation of her murder so far?
Well, at the outset, there was a lot of confusion. I think it seems like it was a lot of chaos. The police weren't very good at maintaining the integrity of the crime scene. The material witness, Gustavo Soto, who finally got to go home to Mexico, he was there in the house when it happened. He said that the crime scene was manipulated. The crime scene, there was photos of the crime scene released before they were shown to us, the family. They were shown in the media, in this conservative media. They made a real mess of the case from the outset. And Gustavo himself was kept in his bloody clothes, interrogated for 36 hours. He was sleep deprived, and he was shown photos of members of the organization that my aunt led, and not asked to draw, you know, not put in front of a sketch artist as you would do to find out who the real killer was. And additionally, the government didn't even look at the dam, which is what she was fighting against, didn't look at the people at the dam until 11 days later that they actually go over to the offices of the people that own the dam and start investigating them.
So Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat from Vermont, issued a statement last month where he basically said the immediate question is what the President Hernandez and his government will do to support an independent investigation, prosecution and punishment of those responsible. And he's one of the people who signed this letter, who's pressuring the Secretary of State and the Treasury Secretary to withhold some money from Honduras pending an independent investigation. You have 60 members of Congress who have signed this letter. Is that a big deal? And do you think that something will happen?
It is a big deal. There was a lot of work put into that to sort of straighten out the facts as to what is happening in Honduras, because the president himself, it was just in a corruption scandal last year where he was allegedly embezzling money from Social Security funds for his campaign. So this guy is not trustworthy. None of these actors are. And Leahy's office thankfully knows that. And we've been up on Capitol Hill. I never even went to the funeral. I went straight to Capitol Hill and I started walking through Capitol Hill and trying to give a sense of reality and the real situation in Honduras and how this could happen. And it is a big deal. We went up there with her daughters. Two of her daughters have now been up there on Capitol Hill with me, and we've been speaking face to face to people, letting them know what's happened. And we've gotten some good support. Congresswoman Pelosi has been very engaged. Another congressman, Hank Johnson, has been very engaged as well. So we're getting the word out. And people are listening to us. Unfortunately, State Department is not.
So meanwhile, what is happening with the dam and the activism there in Honduras?
Well, last week, there was a large march in Tegucigalpa, the capital city. There was also a large march to the dam. Some dam workers were there. And they confronted the marchers who were doing, they were conducting a peaceful march. But the dam workers, for some reason, decided to fight with them and started waving machetes at them and throwing rocks. And four or five people were hurt. And it was a bit of a mess. And it's unclear why they were doing that. It was a peaceful march. There was no antagonizing on the marchers' end. And you know, it just seems it's a bit chaotic in Honduras as well. There's been a few New York Times articles recently that have shown documents where they're talking about police corruption and involvement in assassinations for money, for drug cartels, from drug cartels. And the president has been claiming to be strong on corruption, and so he's been firing top officials and police. And it's just created this fear. It's just chaotic down there, chaotic situation.
All right. Well, I'm going to thank you very much for updating us on that situation.
Sure. No problem. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. That's Silvio Carrillo, freelance journalist based in Oakland, also the nephew of Berta Cáceres, the environmental activist who was gunned down in her home in Honduras last month. Coming up on the program, the comedy business has become yet another example of the gig economy.
A lot of things like don't pay as well, so you have to kind of have like a lot of jobs. Like I do TV recaps, I like do the podcast, I do like live stand-up, I have the book, I do acting stuff.
How to make a buck off a joke, that's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. For today's hardcore comedy fans, there is no shortage of ways to watch your favorite performers. The usuals, of course, comedy clubs and small theaters and TV, but now also podcasts, the web, online content providers like Netflix, Hulu, content hubs such as Funny or Die, College Humor, Twitter, Vine, Instagram. Oh, it goes on and on and on. Well, in this month's issue of Wired Magazine, writer Brian Rafferty asserts that we are in the midst of a comedy revolution and that there is a new comedy economy. And as evidence, he points to the cast of HBO's Silicon Valley.
I just got fired.
And what about me?
Each of the five actors who form the core of the ensemble team are examples of what he claims is an all-new type of comedy star. And joining me to talk about this revolution is Brian Rafferty. His piece is called The New Comedy Economy. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. And joining us also, Phoebe Robinson, co-host of the WNYC podcast, Two Dope Queens. Hi, Phoebe.
Hi, how are you? You can also download on iTunes.
Excellent.
I'm always chilling.
Nice plug. And actor and comedian Brandon Johnson is here with me in the studio. Hi.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. Okay, so Brian, explain what you mean when you say that there is a new comedy economy. What does that mean?
Well, when you think about sort of the 80s and 90s, which was sort of that big epic period for these superstar comedians, when you look at sort of the big names, whether it's Eddie Murphy or Jerry Seinfeld or Roseanne, you know, they kind of made their careers just doing two or three things for the most part. I mean, they did stand-up, or they had a sitcom, or they did both. Sometimes you had people like Tim Allen who had, you know, a hit movie franchise and a hit book and a hit TV show and did stand-up. But for the most part, you know, there were only a couple of outlets for them, and they did these very big things, and they did them very well. And you can also see, you know, movie stars at that time, people like Sandler or Jim Carrey, they would do a movie and then go away for 15, 16 months, do another movie, and sort of not really do a whole lot in between. And now, there's not a lot of stars of that kind of caliber anymore. There are a few. I mean, Melissa McCarthy is huge. Kevin Hart is huge, obviously. Will Ferrell. And what you have now is sort of this kind of new generation of comedians who are doing a little bit of everything. They're trained in a lot of different ways. They're coming up through improv and stand-up or both. And they're getting their comedy out via a number of different mediums, like whether it's podcasts, stand-up shows that they're hosting, stand-up shows that they're running to from around L.A. or New York, doing multiple sets at night, doing sketch show appearances, comedy show appearances, you know, more podcast appearances, podcast interviews. So they're doing a lot of different things, and not always – there might not always be that one huge thing that makes them household names, but there's enough stuff out there now that they can make a living and also, like, have a huge mm-hmm. amount of creative control over what they're doing.
Okay, so Phoebe, you are one of those people who are on podcasts and you have your own podcast. So did you ever think that you would be doing this and whatever else you do to make a living as a comic?
I think I always wanted to be in entertainment. I wanted to work in film, and that's why I moved to New York. And I applied to NYU, and they were like, LOL, your grades are terrible. And I was like, noted. And so I ended up going to Pratt Institute. I did improv in college, like on our campus team, which is like very informal. And then, yeah, here I am 8 years later doing it. It is very much as Brian described. You have to just do a lot of different things. But I think podcasting is such a great avenue for stand-ups in particular, because you can build a fan base very quickly so that you can like go on tour. And then also because you're personal and talking about your life, like industry in air quotes, if you will, like they can see what your brand is, and mm-hmm. they can try and like help package you and stuff. So I really feel like podcasting is like a really, it's a great career move for a lot of people. I know there are a lot of podcasts out, but I just think it's so smart because everyone is different. And so podcasts by its very nature can be very different and represent different kinds of comedians.
Yeah, there are a lot of comedian podcasts out there. I guess mm-hmm. the holy grail would be WTF, Mark Maron's. Mm-hmm. Brandon, do you have a podcast?
I don't have a podcast.
Well, what's wrong with you? Get
I
on the stick.
I don't like to give it away for free. I'll be honest, these jokes, they're very expensive for me to come up with. So I rarely give out just free jokes all day long. The good
here,
thing
right
is,
now.
You know, Twitter and podcasts and these new platforms, they give you an opportunity to actually do that, is give away as much of your art as you possibly can. And it's great because we benefit from technology. There weren't these vehicles prior. It was very difficult to record yourself and friends. So it's great that we have these new platforms to get things out.
Okay, I want to play a clip of tape on a show that you're on. It's called, let me get this right, NTSFSDSUV.
You nailed it. We call it the In Show. That gets us in trouble.
Okay, so this is obviously a play on all those SVUs of
yes.
the world. Okay,
yes.
So here's a clip.
Trent can't do it alone.
Check this out, man. We got the whole crew back together again for you. Gavin Smalls, mathematician. Esteban Tejo, weapons and explosives. Ali Gassner, ghost whisperer. Lieutenant Frank DiCarlo, a detective from the 1970s. RG654, sentient robot. Jimmy and Kip, karate twins. Teresa Howard, bikini model and assassin.
Okay, it goes on and on. We just had to cut it off. It's pretty funny.
So this
originated as a commercial on Children's Hospital.
That's correct.
Which was on Adult Swim.
Yep.
Right, so kind of a box inside a box inside a box.
Right, and these boxes were 15-minute shows.
Yeah.
Instead of doing the usual sitcom 22-minute show, on Adult Swim they did 15-minute shows and stretched those. And they were able to do those, a bunch of those, most of them being parody shows.
So that says something about this new economy, right, Brian, that basically you can find comedy everywhere. And that
Yeah, I mean, you can find it as a comedian. You can also, I mean, one of the things that's great for me is, as someone who is not a comedian but loves comedy, is that I can, you know, find it anywhere as a consumer. I mean, one of the things that's great about podcasts, I mean, obviously your other guests are very young, cool people who live the crazy life. I have two kids and cannot go out and do stuff. So for me, you know, hearing new stand-ups and improvisers on podcasts is, for me, a huge part of my exposure to comedy now. And so is there's so many shows out now and so many shows that just sort of wind up on YouTube, sometimes, you know, legally, sometimes not, that there's plenty of stuff to watch if you love comedy. It's almost too much. Like, I feel like comedy's almost become the same way TV drama is right now, where it's like, could everyone just stop for 2 years so we can all catch up on all the good stuff that's out there?
Yeah.
But it's amazing how many platforms there are for it.
Right. And so, Brandon, I'm wondering if this is over, there was just too much, and that you fear being lost in the sea of all this comedy and all these comic actors.
There is a moment where you have to ask yourself, are you making a lot of non-union and non-billable product? So, in short, you're changing you're shortchanging yourself. If we continue to make a ton of product for free on multiple platforms all the time, then we run the risk of actually losing money on that end. However, there are pieces of every creation that should be sold individually. So I may have a joke that doesn't become a series or doesn't become a web series, but is a great joke to tweet out. And that's the bonus of all the platforms, is that things that are sort of a cupcake versus an entire meal can be consumed by the public.
You made a joke before we started recording about Tim Gunn.
Yes.
Can you just repeat that?
That Tim Gunn's face sort of looks like a cat when it finds out that the family's getting a dog.
Okay, that is so funny. And then Phoebe, you said you should tweet that out.
Did you tweet it?
I did not tweet it. I'll tell jokes in the grocery store to the guy behind the counter, and I'll tell jokes to my mailman. I like doing free stuff like that. But when it comes to Twitter and Facebooking and constant posting, sometimes with the new platforms, you get a sort of a wonky landing.
For me, it's not so much that things have a wonky landing. It's that jokes don't come out perfectly, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think that the wonky part of the process is the most necessary part of the comedy process. So if I think back to some of the things I tweeted when I live tweet the Oscars, I'd be like, I'm kind of a jerk, you know? But like in that moment, I'm like trying to test out, like, does this work? Joke work? Does that work? So I don't know. I think it's not as black and white as that.
You work on Broad City, right?
Yeah, I did consulting work on season 3, and then I was in an episode of season 1. Yeah.
They also seem to be an example of this new economy, because they workshopped their show, or did their show, I guess, online for free. And now they have this, now they're a phenomenon, and Hillary Clinton was on this episode. Is that kind of the trajectory? Brandon, I mean, do you think that, is it still getting to the majors? Is it still being on TV in a traditional format?
I think so, because I think the industry does want to see that you're bankable. And maybe the internet is a way to prove that. It's an actual, it's a harder, more basic way of saying, we've already got eyes on this person. We can prove that we've got eyes on this person via YouTube, via Funny or Die because of the hits. So we can take a chance on them, certainly, on TV.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Brian, I mean, you've profiled the guys from Silicon Valley. So are they at their, I don't want to say their apex, but have they made it?
You know, there is something to be said about having an anchor kind of show. If you're trying to do a bunch of different things, sometimes you're going to be doing a lot of stuff, and especially in this new kind of comedy world where you're not getting paid. I mean, you're going into doing a friend's YouTube video, or, you know, an hour and a half podcast taping is not going to make anyone rich. And I think, you know, the guys in that show and people who are on a lot of other comedy shows or can find some sort of stable gig that pays, that sort of gives you this kind of, you know, leverage and flexibility to do a lot of other things in your career. But I do think the Silicon guys, I mean, I imagine that, you know, other comedians look at them and say, look, those guys can not only have this show that they film, you know, 4 or 5 months out of the year, but they can then go on and do movies and commercials and just sort of do kind of whatever they want and still have this kind of, you know, huge freedom that you might not get if you were on, you know, a network sitcom that you were playing, you know, kind of the third banana role and you weren't crazy about it. And then you only got a few months off to do the stuff you really like to do.
Phoebe, it sounds so exhausting, all this work. Sounds like you're working all the time.
Yes, I do.
Brandon's nodding his head, by the way.
Yeah, I do. I generally speaking, like, I'll work like 7 days a week for like a couple of months, and then I'll have like a couple of days off, and then I start it over again. Because it's just, you know, like Brian says, like, you know, a lot of things like don't pay as well, so you have to kind of have like a lot of jobs. Like, I do TV recaps. I like do the podcast. I do the, you know, like live stand up. I have the book. I do acting stuff. I feel like it's all building, you know, my brand in a way. And I feel like there are people who are like, oh, I started listening to your podcast as I read your recaps on Vulture. And like, if I didn't write those recaps, they wouldn't follow me on Twitter to know that I also have a podcast and then start listening to that. So I feel like as exhausting as it is the smartest way and the quickest way to build a brand, as opposed to waiting for the industry to be like, you black girl who's like not a stereotype, here's a TV show, because that is never going to happen for me. Only once I started doing these things and taking these other avenues have I gotten industry attention, because they're like, oh, well, now here's a thing that we can look at and see what you do.
So it sounds like a young person's game. Someone who doesn't need a lot of sleep.
Yeah, don't need a lot of sleep. And if you're single, it's super helpful.
Right. Or without kids. And Brandon,
yeah,
kids, you've been around for a bit doing the comedy thing.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm not saying you're like the old man here.
He's doing stand-up for Jesus.
I don't know. Do you think that we are in a golden age of comedy? Do you feel like it when you're in it?
I think we're very lucky we do have all different voices in comedy right now, and that's a great thing. So we've got very young people doing comedy, and we've got older people like myself doing comedy. And we're lucky for that because we have this great span. And again, that's what technology has done for us. That's made people who probably were not able to get on stage and do stand-up tweet something out or make a video in Iowa. And that's our new competition. We're up against not just Hollywood and New York. Now we're fighting a battle against very funny people in Michigan who can also go to YouTube and put their stuff up. And I welcome that. So I love it. I think we're always blessed to have the amount of artistry that we have. But what I think mimics us right now is sort of if you look at music or hip-hop, in that hip-hop at once was not something that everyone had access to, and now everyone has access to it. It certainly doesn't make better rappers. It doesn't make better music. But I can say that there's a great sound that comes out of the South that I probably wouldn't have heard before. I would have been stuck listening to L.A. and New York hip-hop. So for comedians and comedy fans alike, you're getting the full spectrum of what's out there.
So that's a good thing for us.
That's a great thing.
Well, thank you guys very much. It was really fun.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is Brandon Johnson. He's an actor and a comedian. Brian Rafferty, senior writer at Wired Magazine, where you can read his article on the new comedy economy. And Phoebe Robinson, co-host of WNYC's Two Dope Queens. And coming up on this program, last night was a big night for HBO with Game of Thrones, Veep, Silicon Valley, but the network is struggling to stay relevant despite debuting Beyoncé's hour-long visual album Lemonade. We'll talk about that next with Eric Deggans on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. HBO had a big weekend. Its popular shows, Game of Thrones, Veep, and Silicon Valley return. And on Saturday, a surprise hour-long visual album dropped from Beyoncé. But looking ahead, HBO may be in some trouble. Girls is ending, as is The Leftovers, and the big budget show Vinyl, well, it's been disappointing. Amazon and Netflix are getting a lot of attention for their original shows. Eric Deggans is here now for our weekly TV roundup. He's TV critic for NPR. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
Well, let's go through the highlights from this weekend in chronological order. And let's begin with Beyoncé's Lemonade. Here's a bit from the trailer.
You're the love of my life. Every fear, wrap your legs around me. What am I doing, my love?
Oh my goodness. Okay, sounds really steamy. Yeah. There were a bunch of directors involved. There's a lot of chatter about her calling out her husband, Jay-Z, for perhaps being unfaithful. What's happening here?
Well, I mean, it feels like what we're seeing is an extension of what we saw with Formation, where Beyoncé is making a statement as a woman. She's making a statement as a Black woman. She's making a statement as an unapologetically Black woman. And she's making a statement as an unapologetically Black woman who's had a very complex life and relationship. Now, we're assuming a bit that the imagery that speaks to infidelity and being a scorned lover is about Jay-Z. And one reason we're assuming that is because there were these rumors that Beyoncé's sister and Jay-Z got in a fight that was captured on tape and became something of a viral video. But at the very least, as Tidal said in a press release, you know, this is about a woman's journey through a lot of different faces, a lot of different changes. Mm-hmm. And it's something of a masterstroke from Beyoncé, who, once again, you know, we saw people are comfortable with her being this pop princess. They're comfortable with her being this mainstream icon. And she has decided to talk about very difficult things, to talk about So there's a portion of the conceptual video that we saw that featured the mothers of slain black women and men holding pictures. Trayvon Martin's mother holding a picture, so we can see the toll that some of these issues involving policing in communities of color, we can see the toll in their faces and in these visuals. And so she is making some very bold statements about policing, about race, about being a woman in contemporary society. That is just it's kind of amazing to see her get to this point as an artist.
And really great for HBO because it makes HBO seem really relevant when some people are wondering whether or not HBO can still remain on top.
Right, exactly. This is a crucial time for HBO. As you pointed out, they've always had free weekends where they let people have cable preview a bit of what they have to offer. And this weekend, between Beyonce and the return of Game of Thrones and Veep and Silicon Valley, three of their most popular shows, last week tonight with John Oliver and Fine Form, it was a really sort of up-to-the-moment, very hip, preview into what HBO can offer subscribers once the free weekend ends and people actually have to pay for access.
Okay, let's talk about HBO's premier comedy, Veep, and why it's so great. Here's a clip from last night's episode where Selena Meyer is tied in the presidential election and her daughter, Catherine, wants to shoot a documentary following this historic tie. And her mom, the president, is hesitant. Her daughter is insistent.
Please, Catherine, stop with the whining, all right? You're going to shatter the bulletproof glass in here. How is it that we did not win Delaware?
Okay, is that a yes to my question?
Okay, she can have full access, okay?
Starting right after we address the situation in Yemen.
Honey, it's Yemen. Life gives you Yemen. You gotta make Yemenade.
Okay, that's the second lemonade reference for HBO this weekend. So put on your critical hat and tell me what you think of this new season so far for Veep and also what you thought of Game of Thrones.
Well, I've always got my critical hat on, so
okay.
That's not a problem.
Good.
But basically, Veep has come back in fine form. What's interesting is that I think a lot of shows that have tried to satirize politics have found themselves in trouble because real life seems to have outpaced anything they can do, particularly on Saturday Night Live. There's a sense that Donald Trump and the Republican contest is so crazy that it's kind of hard to satirize it. But Veep, because it exists in this alternate universe, they can have someone like Selena Meyer, who seems to be, intellectually challenged at times, and surrounded by this dysfunctional family. They can satirize politics in a way that gets at the same things, but is somewhat separate and somewhat different. And that's always great to see. Game of Thrones came back, and this is HBO's most popular series ever. And there was a lot riding on it because they had a lot of cliffhangers the season before that they kind of had to resolve or at least give people a sense they were going to resolve. Of course, we don't know whether or not Jon Snow is still really dead,
right?
Unfortunately, after Sunday's episode, spoiler alert. But we did see some major plot points kind of continued along. We have a sense of what's going to happen. And this, for the first time, is stories that are outside of the books that have been published by George R.R. Martin that the show is based on. So we're in sort of unfamiliar territory here. The author's talked over his major plot points in his upcoming book with the producers, so they have a sense of where he's going. But now we get to see storylines that are crafted pretty much for television and pretty much without worrying about whether or not they connect to the source books in any way, which I think will be a little freeing for the show. I'm interested to see how it goes.
So, Eric, the shows that are doing so well for HBO, they all air on Sunday nights. So what does it have going for the rest of the week?
Well, that's a good question. HBO's always been, a source for movies and great documentaries. They have a lot of great documentaries that kind of are sprinkled throughout the week. They have, Bill Maher's show, which airs on Friday nights. But they have always sort of prioritized Sunday as the place where their original content debuts, and Saturday is the place where they have their high-profile stand-up comedy specials or concert specials, and also when they have their movie debuts. They try to sort of space that out so that they're hitting on Saturdays and with some other stuff, and then they're hitting on Sundays with the original scripted stuff. And they don't seem to be changing that formula very much. They have some ambitious series coming up. The big question is whether or not they'll be as popular as the shows that are going away, particularly when we see how much Vinyl has struggled. They now have a new showrunner that's coming in to replace Terrence Winter, who once worked on Boardwalk Empire. I mean, he was no slouch, but somebody's got to come in and make that show more compelling. And also, it's got to fit in with whatever HBO's vision of itself for the future is.
So do you worry about HBO's future?
Well, it's interesting. These quality TV scripted shows that HBO specializes in, they seem to have a limited shelf life, so to speak. You know, there's a sense in the industry that you can expect a good 5 to 8 seasons out of a high-quality series, and there's a sense that once you start to get past that window, that the show just naturally kind of runs out of things to say, particularly if it's high quality and they're really pouring as much as they can into it. So HBO is always going to face periods where shows that are popular are starting to run down, and they may not yet have booted up new shows that can take their place. We saw this, for example, when The Sopranos was ending and when Sex and the City was ending, and they kind of needed to come up with some new shows to kind of fill the void while those shows were kind of winding down. And, HBO always has to go through this because they can't do what CBS can do with NCIS and CSI and get a formulaic show and just stick it on the air for 10 or 15 years. These shows have very sort of limited lives, and they always have to climb the pump and come up with new and frankly groundbreaking series that can justify the extra money they're asking people to pay for access to the channel.
Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR, thanks for joining us today.
Always a pleasure.
And Christian Bordahl is here sitting in for Julie Myers. Hi there.
Hey there. Well, talking about Beyonce and HBO, as you just were, Brianna Keva says she was absolutely amazed at her display of power through vulnerability. She's on board with Beyonce. And Alex Lopez, he posted a picture of Jay-Z's face on Jon Snow's dead body. So,
as to what Beyonce did to him in that video?
I guess something like that. Read into it what you will. Someone named Pon in Bong Beach says, "What's so groundbreaking? Hashtag Beyonce is stale." So I guess Pon is already over it.
That was fast.
Yeah, that was quick. And earlier you talked with Grace Sonnenschein, Pat Brown Institute, about the 34 candidates are going to be on the ballot in June for Barbara Boxer's Senate seat. I'm not endorsing anyone, but I have to say I like the sales pitch of Mike Badix. He says, "What do all the terrifying issues for the 2016 election have in common? None of them matter, because we're all going to die anyway."
That's his platform?
That's his platform.
So why bother voting, I guess, would be the next question. Christian Bordahl, thank you very much. Warren Olney up next with To The Point. So keep it right here on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.